The Ozarks at Large podcast is made possible by KUAF's contributing listeners. Support from individual listeners in our community helps pay for the cost of producing and distributing this podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast and other digital media produced by KUAF, you can make a contribution at supportkuaf.com.
From the Carver Center for Public Radio, this is 91.3 KUAF, your NPR station for more than 32 years. And this is Ozarks at Large for Monday, July 17th, 2017. Ahead this hour, as the national healthcare situation remains in limbo, considering what works best in the state when it comes to healthcare affordability and accessibility, Dr. Joe Thompson, the former Arkansas Surgeon General, talks about navigating a, at least for now, uncertain health future for the state. First up on this Monday edition of Ozarks, the Community Development Block Grant Program is a flexible program that provides communities with resources to address a wide range of developmental needs. The CDBG program began in 1974 and is one of the Department of Housing and Urban Development's longest continuously run programs. While the amount varies from year to year, the city of Fayetteville typically receives between $600,000 and $700,000 a year. Last Friday, the city hosted an annual picnic to inform the community about the program. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda attended that event, and she has this report.
The threat of rain didn't stop a group of children from enjoying a picnic at Walker Park Friday. Beneath cloudy skies, kids swung on a swing set, spun a prize wheel, and enjoyed some hot dogs. Other community members attended the 10th annual CDBG picnic as well, including firefighters, representatives from local nonprofit organizations, and Mayor Lionel Jordan.
What I hope that people get out of this is that we're all in this together. And, you can market a lot of things, but it's not what we market here, it's what we believe, and we believe in one another and taking care of one another and being together and being a family. In a partnership-based government, we move a city forward together.
The Community Development Block Grant is distributed through the city's Community Resources Division. Yolanda Fields is director of the department, which hosted the annual picnic.
We do assistance programs for individuals that are low to moderate income, and instead of just waiting in the office for them to come in, we want to come out and say, here we are, we want you to know what we do. I think the friendly face approach is always the best.
Those assistance programs are wide-ranging in the services they provide.
We have a rehab program, we have a home repair program, we have a transportation program, we have a pet food pantry to assist individuals, and we also provide case management for our homeless program.
The rehabilitation program provides housing-related services in order to help people preserve their homes. To qualify, an individual has to live in the city of Fayetteville, own their own home, and have lived in it for a year. After applying, Field says they'll come out and inspect the house to see if they can provide repairs within their cap of $25,000. While this program helps repair physical aspects of a home, it can also help the owners emotionally.
We went in and we were going to do the bathroom and the bedroom. Then we realized that the kitchen sink was not, the plumbing wasn't doing well at all. So we did the repair, and then we saw a transformation in the folks that lived there, because then they said, we can do something, and they started painting and they started doing different things. And it was like, we just thought we were never going to catch up. It was like a losing battle, but now we know we can. So that was great.
Field says these initiatives are designed to give people a hand up, not a handout.
We all at different points in our life have situations where we need assistance, and we should be willing to help each other get through those tough times.
Outreach events like the annual picnic are important, Field says, because a lot of people still don't know about the services the Community Resources Division provides. Fayetteville residents can learn more by visiting the department's office, which is located downtown near the intersection of West Mountain Street and South Church Avenue. Field says her office is also happy to come speak at anyone's event.
We're here to provide assistance, whether it be a program that we have or that we can refer, but we want to help our community be the best that it can be.
More information about the Community Resources Division is available at fayetteville-ar.gov. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
The Community Resources Division's office is open from 8 a.m. until 5 p.m. Monday through Friday, and it's located at 125 West Mountain Street in Fayetteville. Nearly 150 young people from across the country are on the University of Arkansas campus this week for a summit devoted to issues surrounding agriculture and native populations. The fourth annual Native Youth in Food and Agricultural Leadership Summit began yesterday with students representing 76 tribes and native populations from Hawaii and Alaska. The summit is hosted by the University of Arkansas School of Law, specifically the school's Indigenous Food and Agriculture Initiative. Janie Sims Hip is the director of the initiative. She returned to the University of Arkansas in 2013 after spending nearly 7 years at the United States Department of Agriculture. She says the students participating in the summit come from many different places and backgrounds and will be able to learn about seed preservation, ethnobotany, the importance of traditional foods, legal issues in Indian country, and much more.
We also give them a healthy dose of financial issues as they relate to food production. We have some intense classroom training around business planning and market development planning, understanding the risks associated with growing food and marketing food and providing food to your communities. But what's often lost, I think, in an understanding of Native peoples in this country is that we've been engaged in food production well before European contact that occurred, you know, centuries ago. And the food production here has been well established among the Native peoples who existed here before that European contact. And so when we say things like traditional foods, some of those foods go all the way back to well before written history. And so the depth of culture and traditions around those foods are so profound that it can be, you know, sometimes a little overwhelming to people who've never thought about our foods in the U.S. or in the world in this way.
It's interesting because you'll potentially could have students here who are, I don't know, from Sitka, Alaska, Quapaw, Oklahoma, Tucson, or Hilo, Hawaii. So I imagine there are many things that wherever the students are from, they have in common. But then there are some things that, because you're talking about a wide geographical area, that are perhaps unique to where they're from.
Exactly. And what we actually have parents who call us sometimes and say, are you going to teach our children how to produce food? You know, my response to that is always there are a lot of other issues related to food and agriculture production that can best be taught at home. You all know as well as I do that every place in the United States is a different growing zone and geographic region. The soils are different. The water's different in terms of availability and frequency. The weather is different. And so it doesn't make a lot of sense for us to try to teach, you know, students from 71 different tribes how to, quote unquote, grow food. That's really something they need to learn at home. But there are some commonalities that we believe are very important for young people to understand as they build their careers around food and you know, being what I call the food people within their communities, because we have a strong need in Indian country for, you know, folks who are the next generation of ethnobotanists, who are the next generation of hydrologists or horticulturalists or whatever, you know, or agricultural engineers or, you know, pick a profession, because ag economists, for instance, or market economists. We have a need across the full spectrum because tribes are investing in food production in all shapes and sizes and varieties within their communities. And so the need for, I call it a strong bench of professional knowledge and young people who literally get their passion identified early and then just stay with it and become the next generation leaders in food and agriculture are extremely important.
Yeah, I mean, food insecurity doesn't, you know, stop where Indian populations live. It's a national, regional, and local issue.
It truly is, and I'm so glad you brought that up. You know, the reality is that for many, far too long, tribes have really, and many tribal communities have had very significant challenges in food insecurity. When I was back at USDA, I actually asked the Economic Research Service at USDA to run the numbers for to determine how much of Indian country, and that's a federal term, and it has a federal terminology, it has a legal meaning in the law, but how much of Indian country was considered to be a food desert under that federal definition. And I was not really surprised, but I did see, and they provided me the evidence then, that literally all of Indian country is a food desert. And so what that means generally is that all of those locations are suffering really some significant challenges in access to food, access to healthy food, access to grocery stores, and in some cases, even access to a convenience store. I mean, some reservations have one convenience store that services the size of a small state, and that is the only food source. And so we just cannot be in a place any longer where those are our statistics. The other piece of the puzzle that people don't really have a full knowledge of is that agriculture production is occurring in Indian country, and it has been for quite some time. The agricultural census, which is taken every 5 years, has identified a high number of American Indian Alaska Native farms and ranches. But the problem is a lot of those foods leave the community. And so you literally are living in an agriculture community, but the food is all going somewhere else, and it's having difficulty getting back.
There are guest lecturers, there are classroom work, but there's also field trips, hands-on learning.
One of our field trips, we're going to spend most of a full day with the Quapaw Tribe of Oklahoma, which are in the far northeast, for some of your listeners may not know. Their original homelands were in Arkansas. The Quapaw are doing some amazing things. They have really been focusing heavily on building out a cattle herd, a bison herd. They have a growing number of greenhouses, a growing number of apiaries. They're just every time you go and talk to them, they're starting a new project with regard to food and agriculture. What we've noticed is, you know, we need the classroom education. We need that kind of, I will say, hardcore training in the classroom. We need that, but we also need the experiential learning and just doing things on the ground. But we also need to learn from each other, and being able to have sort of a varied exposure to the options that are available for having a meaningful life and career in food and agriculture is really such an important thing to share with young people.
Janie Sims Hip is the director of the Indigenous Food and Agriculture Initiative at the University of Arkansas School of Law. The initiative is leading the fourth annual Native Youth in Food and Agriculture Leadership Summit that began yesterday. Nearly 150 students from 76 Native tribes and Hawaiian and Alaskan Native populations are participating in the summit that lasts through June 25th. While here, the students involved with the summit will experience the This Is Hunger exhibit that will make a stop on its national tour in Fayetteville later this week. The free exhibit uses art, storytelling, photography, and interactive features to raise awareness about hunger and abolish some of the stereotypes surrounding hunger. Steve Clark, the president and CEO of the Fayetteville Chamber of Commerce, says it's important that a region with so many positive developments and recent glowing national attention understand hunger exists right here.
And it is a major issue in our community, much more so than most people recognize. So we were intrigued by the national tour and the portrayal of hunger as it exists every day that is not seen. So the person who's working a 40-hour week, maybe making minimum wage or just above minimum wage, and their budget for food is $20 a week or $15 a week, and you're not thinking about that, and you're thinking, wow, well, they can't be hungry, but they can be. The students who are at the school, we have free and reduced lunch for, a substantial number of our students at the school. For our older adult population, we have a lot of people who are living on a fixed income, may live in a very nice house. The chamber got involved in this, we deliver Meals on Wheels on Fridays. We've been doing it for a couple years now. And I think it surprised us. We drove in some pretty nice neighborhoods and thinking, and in one instance it was, it's a former university professor, but he's former meaning about 20 years former, so a long time ago. And so you've got your retirement things and you've got some Social Security, but then you get people who live alone and they don't have any interaction. And so we thought, what a great way for us to take all the resources of Northwest Arkansas that focus on hunger and then say to influencers and citizens, this is where hunger really exists in your community.
The exhibit is in a 53-foot expandable semi-truck trailer, and it will open in downtown Fayetteville on Saturday. Partners for the exhibit locally include the Northwest Arkansas Food Bank, Feed Communities, and Full Circle Food Pantry.
With all those people trying to do everything as well as they can, we still haven't made much of a dent in the problem. And so we were intrigued by the idea that, wow, that's the hunger that we have to address.
Perhaps not every chamber of commerce across the country would bring an exhibit designed to confront a challenge that exists in the community to its town. Steve Clark says he thinks the only way to make a community better is to be upfront about problems like hunger.
Well, we have to emphasize challenges if we're going to get any better. You know, we're growing exponentially, and we want to continue to do that, and we're attracting millennials. And last year, between May of 16 and May of 17, in the Northwest Arkansas metro area, we created more than 12,000 jobs. Talent can go anywhere, and to get talent, you have to have communities that can say, we're not afraid of our challenges. We're going to speak to them directly. We're going to work to address them directly. And we are a community, so we, in one sense, are our brother's keeper. And for us, and we see it, so there's about 35,000 people went to work in Fayetteville today. So 10,000 or so of those are in some sort of sales or service job. 7,500 are in some sort of healthcare job. 7,500 are in some sort of education job. So, you get up to 25,000. It's about 5,000 in some sort of manufacturing, and 5,000 that, maybe 6,000 manufacturing, 4,000 that are in some sort of governmental position thing. And you're thinking, well, if they're working, they can't be hungry. And that's just not true. And most of the hunger that we don't see is the result of someone having some incident in their life where their life, their budget, their plans get knocked askew, and they got to decide, do you buy medicine or do you buy food? And yes, you can grow gardens, and yes, you can do that. And yes, we have the Northwest Arkansas Food Bank got 35,000 pounds of food I saw just recently, and all that is very, very good. And we should do all of that that we can. But I talked to Dr. Wendt at the public schools about this about a month ago, and he said it's unacceptable that we have students who would leave here on Friday, and if we didn't pack a backpack full of food for them, they might not eat all weekend. It's just unacceptable. He's right. It is. And if we're going to be the community we like to be and want to be and speak of being, then it has to be unacceptable.
Steve Clark is the president and CEO of the Fayetteville Chamber of Commerce. The traveling exhibit, This Is Hunger, will be in the parking lot at Church and Center across from City Hall in downtown Fayetteville, beginning Saturday and remaining there through July 26th. While the exhibit is free, reserve times are strongly encouraged. The exhibit is a project of Maison, a Jewish response to hunger. You can learn more and reserve times at thisishunger-fayetteville.eventbrite.com, or you can find that link at ozarksatlarge.com.
91.3 KUAF is supported by Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, celebrating the American spirit by uniting the power of art with the beauty of nature. The museum and its restaurant 11 open until 9 p.m. Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays. Reservations for dinner at crystalbridges.org/11. Additional support provided by Highlands Oncology Group, helping patients fight the battle every day with a team of cancer specialists in both Benton and Washington counties. Services include radiation, CLIA-certified labs, a multidisciplinary lung clinic, and a lung cancer screening program. HighlandsOncologyGroup.com.
And just ahead on Ozarks at Large, trying to figure out where Arkansas's healthcare future rests as the national conversation continues.
You know, I think we need to keep our eye on the ball of what's going to be the best for Arkansans. Our health policy board met yesterday and debated a number of different issues, and I think we have to figure out how to get health care coverage for all Americans, regardless of age, income, or geography.
How a national health care conversation still in progress might affect what Arkansas does. That's ahead on today's Ozarks at Large. The week's forecast can be summed up easily enough: clear and hot. Lows tonight and tomorrow night will be in the upper 60s in northwest Arkansas, lower to mid-70s in the Arkansas River Valley. Highs this week will be reaching into the mid-90s in northwest Arkansas, and every day this week, upper 90s for the Arkansas River Valley. Highs of 97, 98, and 99 degrees, with heat index level as high as 109 for the Arkansas River Valley by the end of the week.
On the next Fresh Air, James Foreman Jr. talks about his book Locking Up Our Own, examining the role played by the African-American community and political leaders in creating the era of mass incarceration. He's the son of James Foreman, who headed the civil rights group SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. James Jr.'s grandmother was Jessica Mitford. Join us.
Fresh Air, twice every weekday at 11 a.m. and 6 p.m. on 91.3. Both of those broadcast times right before Ozarks at Large. If you're paying attention to the latest attempts in the United States Senate to create a revised national health care plan, you know reaching a consensus, even among 52 people in the same political party, is complicated. Add opinions from the other side of the aisle, 50 states own particular plans, and the inevitable mathematical equations involved with pricing and the challenges to form healthcare are imposing. This week, Roby Brock, with our partner Talk Business and Politics, asked Dr. Joe Thompson about the possible futures for Arkansans and healthcare. Thompson is the president and CEO of the Arkansas Center for Health Improvement and has been closely involved with Arkansas and healthcare for some time. He served as Arkansas Surgeon General during both Governor Huckabee and Governor Beebe administrations. Roby asked Joe Thompson where he stands in regards to the latest efforts to formulate a health care plan.
You know, I think we need to keep our eye on the ball of what's going to be the best for Arkansans. Our health policy board met yesterday and debated a number of different issues, and I think we have to figure out how to get health care coverage for all Americans, regardless of age, income, or geography.
All right, let's start first with the Affordable Care Act, then before we move to the Senate plan. Name me one or two things that would have the most impact on Arkansans if you could fix, correct, change something.
You know, Arkansas is actually leading the nation because of the strategy we took. Nationwide, in the individual health insurance marketplaces, they are deteriorating to a place that they're likely to fail. we put a Medicaid purchaser in the middle of our marketplace to have a guaranteed purchaser to make sure we got healthy people as well as sick people. Too many other exchanges are only getting sick people. So incentives, penalties, reinsurance mechanisms to help stabilize those insurance pools nationwide would be helpful.
Is this the private option? Is this the Medicaid expansion plan?
I'm talking about what we did was the private option, now the governor's Arkansas Works plan. And some other states have done similar things, but nobody on a scale that we did and has had as much success as we have.
So we're not having some of the failures that other states are having, but we still have plenty of people complaining that they have insurance premiums going up, maybe not at the rate that we're seeing other states. But so tell me something that could correct that situation here with the current law.
So I think on the premium rate increases, the most important thing is to get the healthy people to buy in and to displace the cost of the sick people. That's how health insurance works, is we have to get healthy people to buy in before they know whether they're going to have an illness, and when they do have an illness, have enough healthy people that didn't have an illness to offset the cost. We know that about 3/4 of the people who are eligible for a tax credit to buy health insurance in this state did not buy it. Mm. Those are likely the healthy people, and that would help everybody's health insurance rates if they came into the plan.
All right, so let's turn to what is going on in Washington, D.C. By the end of this week, we actually saw a revised GOP Senate plan here. I think one of the bigger changes to it is it does allow a bare bones premium type plan for not sick individuals. How do you think that would impact things?
So I think the debate in Congress on both sides, House and Senate, really is philosophically about should we cover individuals, and if so, how do we pay for it? And I think the American people have moved beyond that. I think they think everyone should have a mechanism to get health care coverage. The bare bones approach is attractive for younger, healthy people who don't need care and can get a lower premium by having a catastrophic or a bare bones package. The problem is it keeps them outside of the risk pool where the sick people are. Any strategy that separates the healthy from the sick is going to lead to an unstable insurance product for the ill.
So what else have you seen in this revised Senate plan that you think is good for Arkansans,
sure,
and what maybe something that you see as bad for Arkansans?
So I think in the revised Senate plan, there was a recognition that the one-size-fits-all benefit package needed to have some modifications, that the richness of the package may have been too broad. As we just talked about, I think the catastrophic package is too narrow. But to find a middle ground where there was some opportunities for folks to have more flexibility in what they purchase, I think that would be good not only for the Arkansas marketplace, but also nationwide.
You see that in the plan right now, though?
I think there are the options. I think in the non-revised Senate plan, there were the options for states to take that on.
Okay.
In the same vein, in the revised Senate plan, one of the things that I think is most concerning is that it's now not a state decision whether to take that on. It's an insurance plan decision whether to take that on. So insurance plans could decide, we're going to have a non-essential health benefit, stripped down, cheap plan that we're going to offer over here, and we're going to have an Affordable Care Act single compliant plan over here. The healthy people are coming to the less expensive plan. The sick people are going to be in the Affordable Care Act plan, and we're going to end up again with an adverse risk selection that destabilizes the health insurance.
So what do you see in the Senate revised GOP plan that you think is good for Arkansas?
Yeah, I think the weight of the Senate revised plan overall is still caused drastic cuts and negative impacts for the state. It reduces Medicaid matching funds, which our General Assembly, every year they have passed, the private option or Arkansas Works, have said, if that ever happens, we terminate the program. So that's 300,000 Arkansans that I think likely would lose their insurance coverage. Secondly, it reduces the growth rate of Medicaid over time, so I think our seniors and disabled individuals would have less funds available. And finally, in the Senate plan, it really doesn't fix the health insurance rules that are necessary to have a stable private marketplace.
Give me an example of what you're talking about.
Well, as I just mentioned, it's all about the stability of the marketplace. If you say, we're not going to have pre-existing conditions, but you can come buy health insurance whenever you want to, I'm going to keep my money until I get sick, and then I'm going to go buy health insurance, and it's not going to work. Like I told you before, I don't get to buy car insurance after I wreck my car. Why would I get to buy health insurance after I get sick?
Yeah.
Insurance doesn't work that way.
Let's talk about Medicaid. You brought it up there just a minute ago, and that has obviously been Governor Hutchinson's concern, is that I think earlier, before the revised Senate plan, this could blow a $500 million hole in Arkansas's budget. We haven't seen a revised CBO score yet, so we don't really kind of understand what the impact may be at this point. What's wrong with block grants coming to the state of Arkansas? What's wrong with there being some sort of cap on Medicaid in the long run?
Sure. So first, I want to commend our governor for his outspoken, you know, statements and I think rational conversation with our congressional delegation and the public about what needs to happen. The block grant scenario has been requested for a long period of time, mostly by the more conservative side of governors and state leaders. The block grant puts a cap. Right now and historically, the Medicaid program has been a partnership. If money, more money was needed, the feds paid a portion and the states paid a portion. It was a partnership where, in our situation, the feds usually paid about 70% of every dollar, the states paid 30%. What a block does is it puts a cap on that. It sets what the feds will pay, so any future growth is all the responsibility of the states. And I think that's where there's concern that in times of economic downturns or in times of growing health care costs, that the state would be left on the hook to bear the full burden, not the partnership burden, of those costs.
So traditional Medicaid 70-30 split between the feds and the state under the Affordable Care Act, the Medicaid expansion
was much higher.
Much higher. It's around 90-10 right now, though it was 100% in its earlier. Any problem, do you think, with moving Medicaid expansion funding back to 70-30?
I think
obviously less money, but fairness-wise.
Obviously, the expansion passed by then the Democratic Congress had a big enticement for states to expand.
It was the incentive.
It was the financial incentive.
Yeah, right.
And states like ours was different in that we found a private way to do it, but we took that incentive and we actually got coverage for 300,000 previously uninsured Arkansans in the state. A reduction in the matching rate, while it might be more fair, I think needs to be tied to what is the formal relationship between the state and the federal government. If you reduce the match rate and you put a block grant in so that future growth is the state's responsibility, I think it's a double whammy and a transfer that the states won't be able to entertain.
All right, last question for you. You want to make a prediction on whether or not the Senate GOP plan gets out of the Senate?
I will make this prediction for you.
All right.
Nationwide, the private individual marketplaces are destabilizing and many will fail because they don't have a force like we have in Medicaid buying private coverage. So Congress must act. I think you're going to have a bipartisan effort come together to find a solution for the parts of the Affordable Care Act that do work and a patch or a revision or a new program for the parts of the program that do not work.
Dr. Joe Thompson is the president and CEO of the Arkansas Center for Health Improvement and a former Surgeon General for the state of Arkansas. He talked with Roby Brock from our partner, Talk Business and Politics, this weekend. You can follow news stories revolving around Arkansas business news and politics every day at talkbusiness.net and every weekday afternoon, a podcast devoted to Arkansas news. This is Ozarks at Large. It's Monday, the 17th day of July, 2017. I'm Kyle Kelms. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studios, Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
Man, it used to be you couldn't get Fayetteville people in Springdale, and now you can't get them out. I'll tell you what. Olivia Trimble is going to be the speaker at noon Wednesday at the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History. They do this thing once a month. You get snacks, you get a noon speaker. She's going to talk about sign painting,
which she knows a lot about.
She just did the great big Experience Fayetteville sign at the Fayetteville Visitors Bureau. And she's done a bunch of other stuff.
If you drive by Dixon Street Liquor, the Ozark Brewing logo is on the side of DSL, which is really cool.
Well, she's going, I don't know how she's going to do this in what's supposed to be about an hour, but she says she's going to talk about how fortunate we are in the Ozarks to have ghost signs, which is the signs on the sides of usually brick buildings.
Coca-Cola or something like that. And they're kind of fading.
Yeah, that have stuck around because we haven't done something awful to them. Whereas if it's vinyl, it just peels off. She wants to talk about the process of sign painting and why it's valuable and how as a trade, it kind of died off, but there's a little bit of a resurgence now. She wants to talk about its hard work, because it doesn't matter if you're painting the side of a building, making something cool, or painting lines on a tennis court.
Yeah.
You know.
Right, yeah.
And she's going to talk about what she's working on right now. She says, this is not just painting cutesy signs on chalkboards.
Are you going to go to this? I can't, because it's right in the middle of the work
day. I love going to these.
Ask her, if you get a chance, what she thinks. Years ago, I interviewed people who had written the book Ghost Signs of Arkansas, and they documented from the Delta to the Ozarks. Their feeling was that you just let them fade. You don't paint them anew.
Mm.
And apparently, among these aficionados of these kinds of signs, it's a deep split. Those who think you just let time and the sun do its work and eventually fade them out. And those that say, no, after about 40 years, touch them up and make them new again. So ask her what she thinks about that.
Interesting question, and I will.
And then report back.
I will.
Thank you.
And coming Thursday night to Nightbird Books in Fayetteville, an old friend of mine, Margaret Rutherford, mm-hmm. we were in Second to None, the Fayetteville History Play together.
Years ago. I mean, you know, a while
back. A minute or two ago. Yeah. He's in trouble now.
Well, I went to it, so I'm aging myself as well.
Well, some of us have hair color. She has her first book out. She is everywhere as a psychologist. She's on blogs. She's on Huffington Post. She is everywhere. But she has written a book that came out in April called Marriage is Not for Chickens. And it started life as a blog post. Mm-hmm. And then it became, she spent 2 years working with photographers, one from Pine Bluff and one from up here, creating images to go with the words. And so now this book is out, and she's going to read from it and sign books at a reception from 5:30 to 7:30 Thursday at Nightbird Books. Did you know?
Probably
not. You probably did. That she was a professional vocalist in Dallas.
Did not know that.
In the 80s, and started volunteering at a domestic violence shelter. Ended up becoming the volunteer coordinator, and that realized that even though she loved to sing, she wanted to do this thing, earned a music therapy degree, earned her PhD in 1992.
Wow.
And here she is, and her writing's been in Huffington Post and Reader's Digest and Psychology Today and the Good Men Project and Midlife Boulevard. And so you should go and meet her, because she's pretty cool.
Marriage is Not for Chickens, the name of the book.
Also a great fact.
Yeah. What do you think about ghost signs? Yes or no? Let them go or touch them up?
Wow.
Well, think about that. See what Olivia says.
I'll think
says.
About it.
All right.
I'll ask Olivia. We'll talk about this next week.
Okay, very good. Becca Martin Brown is the features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
With the Department of Arkansas Heritage, I'm Mark Christ of the Arkansas World War I Centennial Commemoration Committee. 100 years ago, speakers known as Four-Minute Men gave speeches at local theaters urging the purchase of Liberty Bonds. On July 27, 1917, the Arkansas Gazette reported that local businessman E.J. Bodman claimed his speech at Little Rock's Royal Theater that night is going to be a great hit. He is absolutely sure it will be followed by prolonged applause because he is not going to speak. Instead, the newspaper reported, Betty Brooks, a Little Rock girl singer who had won fame in opera, musical comedy, and vaudeville in Chicago and New York, would sing a four-minute speech. Her song, titled We Will Make the Kaiser Wiser, was written by Little Rock publicist and Glad Hand man Carl Baer. Originally intended to be sung to the tune of Battle Hymn of the Republic, Miss Brooks changed it to follow Yankee Doodle, which had more pep, and the Gazette allowed, it must be admitted, is filled with the essence of the old Cayenne. To learn more, visit ww1arkansas.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. There is a new consul general in the Republic of the Marshall Islands consulate, headquartered in Springdale. Eldon Ehrlich has been named to the post, according to a press release issued this weekend by the RMI Embassy in Washington, D.C. Ehrlich replaces longtime Marshallese Consul General Carmen Chong-Gam. Ehrlich has served as an interpreter for state courts and federal government agencies for the Marshallese community in Salem and Portland, Oregon. Among the responsibilities of the Consul General, safeguard legal rights and property interests of Marshallese in Arkansas, and facilitate trade between both nations. A new study suggests Fayetteville is among the cities experiencing the least amount of inflation in the country. The report, created by the firm Smart Asset, places Fayetteville as the metro area with the fifth lowest rate of inflation in the U.S. The city has, according to the study, seen a nearly 4% increase in the average personal income in the past year, while experiencing a cost of living increase of just under 1% during the same time period. Burlington, Iowa, Kalamazoo, Michigan, Dubuque, Iowa, and Ashland, Ohio were the only cities with lower rates of inflation over the past year, according to the report. Another report, this one from George Mason University, places Arkansas in the top 20 states in the nation when it comes to fiscal condition. That's up 8 spots since the same report was issued last year. The authors say several items are considered when compiling this study, including a state's ability to attract business and how well a state keeps promises to public sector employees. Florida is ranked first. New Jersey is ranked last. Oklahoma has a 7th place ranking, and Missouri is listed as the 11th best when it comes to fiscal condition. And gas prices across Arkansas are about a half penny higher this week than this time last week. The website GasBuddy.com reports a survey of more than 1,800 gas stations in the state puts the average gallon of gas at $2, still almost a quarter per gallon cheaper than the national average, and far less expensive than the average price of gallon of gas this day in 2014. That's when the cost was $3.46 a gallon. This is Ozarks at Large. Fayetteville is one of several hundred U.S. cities collaborating to curb climate change. And among several dozen municipalities trying to preserve scientific climate data scrubbed from the EPA's website. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich explains.
After taking office last January, President Donald Trump removed all mention of climate change from the official White House website, replacing it with an America First energy plan. The plan calls for lifting restrictions on oil, natural gas, and coal mining to, quote, make America wealthy again. 4 months later, on Earth Day, EPA's new director, Scott Pruitt, ordered climate change information and data removed from his agency's website. Concerned scientists took to the streets, marching in protest, while a dozen environmentally progressive mayors took to their computers.
Okay, so you got to go to our official site, which is right here.
Fayetteville Mayor Lionel Jordan chose us where the EPA data is now safely stored, seated in front of his computer in his sun-drenched office.
When you get the master plans, there's our energy action plan. And there you go.
Fayetteville's energy action plan, approved by City Council this winter, Jordan says, is a residential mandate. A recent survey shows 78% of residents prioritize renewable energy adoption.
And when we knew that 62%, this was an interesting statistic, of federal residents would like the city to prioritize climate change preparedness.
The city has responded by reducing greenhouse gas emissions, he says.
Emissions that causes the global warming, the melting, and we've got to look at ways. We got to get off the fossil fuels and get onto the renewable.
Fayetteville's Energy Action Plan is based on the Paris Climate Accord, from which the Trump administration has exited. Jordan, along with several hundred U.S. mayors, however, have vowed continued support.
We believe that climate change is real. We felt as though everybody should have all the information. We felt that that was important information, so we took the information from Chicago, and I've got to give them a lot of credit.
Credit to the city of Chicago for saving the purged EPA climate data. Chris Wheat is chief sustainability officer for the city of Chicago in Mayor Rahm Emanuel's office.
Yeah, so Mayor Emanuel recognizes the gravity of climate change and the importance of the work of scientists and federal employees over the last several decades to better refine exactly what is climate change, why is it important, and ultimately what we can do about it.
Just before Trump took office, Wheat says, City of Chicago IT staff began to download EPA's climate change website content.
The mayor felt it was important to not only provide this information on the Chicago website, but to work with cities like Fayetteville and other cities around the country to put this information up on their sites as well.
EPA's now-preserved digital climate information portal is easy to navigate through, he says.
It provides some basic data about how the Earth is warming, how temperatures have been rising, how we're already seeing the impacts of climate change in the United States and in different parts of the world. It also provides information to everyday Americans, to businesses, to children about the different things that they can do to actually begin to counteract and mitigate the impacts of climate change.
14 cities, including San Francisco, Boston, Houston, and Fayetteville, Arkansas, are linked to the database now, hosted by the City of Chicago.
The diversity of cities that have been involved in this project really speaks to how important this data is and how important climate change is to residents around the country. It's not just a big city versus small city or a blue state versus small state issue. It's an issue that should provide concern and opportunity for all of us.
Wheat says Chicago's Department of Innovation and Technology placed the information on GitHub, which is an open source website.
The reaction that we've seen and our ability to work with so many cities around the country really speaks the importance of science and the importance of data.
Chris Wheat says Chicago has become a model for reducing carbon emissions and promoting sustainability, as indicated by its own data just released.
Showing that Chicago's emissions are down roughly 7% from 2010 to 2015. That's at the same time that we're seeing growth in Chicago's population, in its economy, and the number of jobs.
Chicago plans to source 100% renewable energy by 2025 for all municipal buildings and is retrofitting 170,000 streetlights with LED fixtures. Fayetteville Mayor Lionel Jordan says it's up to cities now, given the lack of federal will, to carry on with ecological restoration.
There may be changes in the federal government, but this city stays the same. We haven't changed. We're still the same city we've always been. We're going to protect our environment.
And apparently, Fayetteville residents are checking out the conserved EPA climate database, according to webpage analytics provided by the city. In June alone, the climate change page received 257 views. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs. Monroe County native and rhythm and blues pioneer Louis Jordan's musical influence is broad. So broad, it extends to performers considered to be musical innovators themselves. Chuck Berry, James Brown, B.B. King. Ray Charles was another Jordan acolyte and covered several Jordan songs, such as Early in the Morning, Let the Good Times Roll, Choo 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 Boogie, and had a hit with Jordan's song, Don't Let the Sun Catch You Crying. By the early 1960s, Ray Charles' star had risen to the point where he rated his own Vanity record label. In contrast, Louis Jordan of Brinkley hadn't had a hit since the early 1950s. By 1961, Jordan had even disbanded his backing group, the Timpani Five, was without a recording contract and working as a guest star with other groups. So the offer to record for Charles' new record label, Tangerine, must have been welcome news to Jordan and his fans.
When I come home in the evening, you better have my dinner hot. I want to smell that old pot roast while it's stewing in the pot. Have my bubble bath waiting and my change of clothes laid out. And when I ask you to light my cigarette, give me a smile and don't you pout. You heard just what I said. Like this, if you don't straighten up, baby, there are gonna be some changes made.
On his sessions for Tangerine Records, Louis Jordan recorded with the big band that recorded with Ray Charles, and most of the arrangements were by Ernie Freeman. Several singles and an album called Hallelujah, Louis Jordan is Back were issued on Charles's label. Unlike the low points of his post-1940s recordings, Louis Jordan isn't trying to redo his classic hits with a rock and roll backbeat. But Jordan did pull out his food song Coleslaw, an obscurity he originally recorded in 1949, which extols the benefits of the cabbage dish as served in his home state. Jordan also audaciously does a version of What I Say, an important hit for Ray Charles, just a few years before.
Yeah, see the girl with the snaggle tooth. She hardly ever tells the truth, What I Say.
Although Louis Jordan was happy with the music from the Tangerine Sessions, he was not with the music's distribution, which was handled by Ray Charles's home label, the huge corporation ABC Paramount. Jordan told of bringing copies to disc jockeys himself and taking the album to sell at shows while on tour with Mom's Mabley. Even years later, Jordan complained to interviewers that DJs had played the Tangerine material, but consumers could not find the records in stores. "I think he must have signed me up as a tax deduction or something," Louis Jordan said of Ray Charles. Jordan's widow, Martha, agreed that Jordan could never understand why Charles, in their eyes, did not push the Jordan records after being aggressive in getting him to sign to Tangerine. Louis Jordan's affiliation with Ray Charles's Tangerine label ended in 1964. Other notables on the label include Percy Mayfield, who wrote Ray Charles's smash song Hit the Road, Jack, Ike and Tina Turner, and the Ohio Players. Charles's female singers, the Raylettes, also recorded for Tangerine. The leader of the Raylettes for many years was Mabel John, who was raised in Ouachita County. Tangerine Records folded when Ray Charles left ABC Paramount in 1973. By then, Louis Jordan was in Paris, recording for another label what would be his last album. Louis Jordan died February 4th, 1975. Here in its entirety is Louis Jordan on Tangerine Records with Never Know When a Woman Changes Her Mind, one of his four singles on Ray Charles's label from the early 1960s, written by Floyd Dixon.
Came home this morning about 3:30. And my baby had walked out on me. Women will fool you, do it every time. You never know when a woman is gonna change her mind. Always love me. Trust very few, 'cause when you fall in love, they'll walk out on you. As I go through life, here's what I find. You never know when a woman's gonna change her mind. Since the beginning of Adam and Eve, a man has suffered and he has grieved. But there's one secret no doctor can find. That's to tell when a woman gonna change her mind.
Never Know When a Woman Changes Her Mind by Louis Jordan of Brinkley in Monroe County on Ray Charles's Tangerine label. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of Experiment Station Studios. Executive producer is Keith Merks. Arkansongs is underwritten by the Old State House Museum in Little Rock, a museum of the Department of Arkansas Heritage. Arkansongs, since 1998.
Tickets are available for the Wheels of Soul 2017 Summer Tour featuring Tedeschi Trucks, the Wood Brothers, and Hot Tuna at the Walmart Amp in Rogers, July 25th. Tickets at amptickets.com or 443-5600.
A service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is 91.3 KUAF. Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Mulberry. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks for listening.